It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ooh.
It's in stereo.
Yeah, I was going to say, you guys have been practicing.
Yes. We're sort of like trained seals, only better.
All right. Well, we're running a couple minutes short, so let's dive in.
It's a very cute ball, by the way.
Yeah, for those getting the video feed. Starting out with local and our city council and a budget hearing coming up.
Yes, you would think that in these tough economic times with the city of Seattle's budget coming up, that they would be looking to tighten their belt and cut back on the vanity projects. And you would be well half right, actually. They are looking at doing dramatic cutbacks in social services. Hearings on the budget will begin Monday morning at City Council, and a number of groups are going to be descending on City Hall to voice their opinions. But there are a couple of fairly problematic areas of the budget that the same politicians who seem to think that three ballot measures to raise our taxes were a great idea on the ballot a couple of weeks ago, and of course they all in fact did pass, so maybe they know something that we don't. But There are a couple of budget things that are really pretty questionable and starting to get some flack from City Council Member Nick Licata in particular, but also some of the community activists who follow such things. One is the prospect for a new jail that would be at least in theory jointly operated by the City of Seattle and King County and or some of the component suburban cities in King County. Costs $110 million to build and $19 million annually to operate after that. And they haven't figured out where they're going to site it yet, although one of the parcels of land they're looking at it, ironically enough, was the first place that Nicholsville was sited a few weeks ago. So, you know, if the homeless had just stayed there for a little while, the jail could have been built around them. But the problem with this, of course, is that the city planners are saying, well, a new jail is inevitable because of our burgeoning population of people who need to be incarcerated. The only problem with that is that the vast majority of people who, quote-unquote, need to be incarcerated don't, in fact, need to be incarcerated. They're nonviolent drug offenders, and the city does, in fact, have diversion programs that have proven to be very successful both here and in other cities, and that are facing cutbacks with the budget, which is very much penny-wise and pound-foolish because they're, well, not even penny-wise particularly, because it saves the city a lot of money. It helps keep the city and the courts from destroying people's lives over a quote-unquote crime that really hasn't harmed anybody, except maybe themselves, depending on what you think of drug laws. And instead, we're going to build an enormous new jail somewhere in the city. So that's one area of concern. The other area of concern is Mayor Nichols' plan to quote-unquote fix the Mercer miss, which is basically an elaborate plan to put more money in the pocket of Paul Allen and Vulcan and so forth, doesn't fix it at all. In fact, a number of traffic studies have shown that turning Mercer into a two-way street, which is sort of the key component that they're trying to fund, won't help traffic a bit. But what it will do is improve access to some of Allen's properties and improve their property value. And
Beautify the neighborhood.
And
really,
there's also a fund there that will directly funnel some of the money to the landowners in the area. And hey, guess who's one of those landowners?
Yeah, it's really sort of the Paul Allen idea of the Seattle Commons getting built anyway, just through the city council deciding to allocate funds here and there for small projects to eventually make what Allen wanted in the first place, which is sort of a beautified place for him to own land and to
build townhomes with mixed retail on the first floor.
Right, and to build these enormous buildings for large-scale tenants like Amazon.com, etc. So, what's really interesting to me about the Mercer mess is about this Mercer improvement thing is Jan Drago is proposing that we go ahead and release the money to do the first property purchases for it at a time when property values are sliding and have not reached their bottom yet. And I have to ask, why by now? Why, you know, the best time would probably be 6 months from now. But of course, no, she's in a hurry to release the funds to buy the properties now so that Paul Allen and other folks who are selling the land that will go to expand Mercer, those folks will get a good price still.
And there's two answers to that question of why now. One of them is that if you sell it now at an inflated price, the property owners like Paul Allen will basically get a pretty sizable windfall from the city. That's one issue. The second issue is that Jan Drago is almost certainly retiring next year, and she's trying to get her licks in for her friends while she still can.
Yeah, before she gets replaced by somebody who's going to be a more progressive person, we can all cross our fingers for
that.
Yeah,
we can work on that.
Yeah.
Well, you're still suffering from that buzz from the elections, I can see.
Yeah, right. our delusions haven't fully worn off yet.
That's
all
true.
Right. All right, moving on. The Port of Seattle says yes to taxes.
Yeah, speaking of, this is a direct line from Seattle voters approving those levies on November 1st, because our good old friend Pat Davis, thinking of people who won't be running for re-election next year but should be ineligible based upon future felony convictions.
Felony convictions. We
yes.
can only hope.
Yes. Said in response to the Port of Seattle's commissioners voting 4-0 to raise taxes on the levy by 11% next year, even though they're still rolling over money from 2008. Gail Tillerson, by the way, was not present, so she was the only one of the commissioners who did not vote for this, although she may have. We don't really wanted to. We really don't know. Anyway, Pat Davis.
So the port is raising our taxes even though they don't need the money,
yes,
essentially.
That's the short way of putting it. Thank you. But Pat Davis talking about how the passage of those levies in November showed that it was a good time in terms of the economy that there was support for making investments now. I don't think Pat actually lives in a world where there's an economic downturn and where people are being affected by this. I suspect she's being well enough taken care of by all of her big business patrons that she really hasn't noticed.
It really shows her profound inability to understand basic economic principles. During a downturn, one of the last things you want to do is jack up people's taxes as an excuse to spend money and create jobs. The idea behind the government bailout plan right now at the federal level is to spend money without jacking up people's taxes. Pat Davis hasn't figured that out yet.
Yeah, well, I think you're giving her too much credit. She probably is perfectly aware of that. She's just looking for public justifications for what the Port of Seattle wants to do anyway. But it underscores once again how completely unaccountable to the public the Port of Seattle has been. That's been a long, long-term problem in this region. And gosh, it sure would be nice. Drop hint. If some progressive folks ran for the Port of Seattle Commission next year.
All right. Moving on, finally, for local update on Nicholsville.
Yeah, since it can't be cited where a future jail will be built, at least, I don't know, they're probably going to build so many jails that at some point there will be one on every street corner, sort of like McDonald's or Starbucks. But Nicholsville has been housed for the last couple of months in a parking lot across the street from University Christian Church in the U District. That arrangement is coming to an end at the end of November, so if you know of any kind of hopefully permanent place where 100-plus homeless people can live without being persecuted by the city, they would very, very much like us people's assistance on that.
Maybe a closed-down Starbucks here and there.
Yeah,
that would
work.
Good idea.
That'd definitely
work.
Those
new parking meters that they've got everywhere, those look pretty solid. They could just tie people up in front of their, you know, houses to those. All right. Let's go work on that one.
Okay.
I don't like those things. Anyway, let's move on to national.
Clearly.
Where did that come from?
I like the taking over vacant Starbucks
Well, yeah, because since, you know, some former baristas are probably living in Nicholsville.
Yeah, sure.
Let's move on to national and this week's economic news.
Yeah, I've been asked a lot of questions this week from people. One of the big ones is, what the heck is a bank holding company? After news this week that American Express and Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and some other companies have been able to convert to bank holding companies and then qualify for Treasury bailout funds.
Yeah, Toys R Us did it, too.
The most shocking of these is American Express converting very quickly to a bank holding company and now qualifying for something like $3.8 billion from the Treasury. People naturally want to know, what is this bank holding company thing and how can I do it? Well, a bank holding company really is any entity, so any company that owns or controls 25% or more of the stock in a U.S. bank. So about a quarter of the, if you own or control about a quarter of the stock in a U.S. bank. Now, companies that and other entities that do that don't have to be considered bank holding companies. In order to become one, they have to apply to the Treasury, and then the Treasury looks at their paperwork and usually takes months to decide. But in the case of American Express, they sped up the process and decided in a matter of a couple of weeks that, yes, American Express qualifies to be a bank holding company. In fact, there's a downside to being a bank holding company, which is why most of these big investment banks haven't applied to become one until now. The big downsides are that they have to be regulated by the Treasury, which then can set minimum capital requirements, that is how much cash and other assets a bank has on its balance sheet versus how much it can loan out and how much money it can borrow. So there's some stringent restrictions and some regulations on bank holding companies that a lot of big public banks like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley didn't want to be subject to until just recently, when they found out that, well, if I do apply to become a bank holding company, then I can get this money from the Treasury. Well,
free money.
Free money, yes. Well, it's not exactly free. It's an extremely low interest loan from the Treasury, but there's the understanding that if the bank can't pay that loan back, maybe somewhere down the line the government will forgive it, so it could become free money. So now you might have a question of, okay, what is the difference between these investment banks and, you know, traditional banks? I don't really understand what that is. Well, you have to understand that there are different types of financial companies that make up the whole financial, what's called the whole financial industry. There are commercial banks. That's the bank you can go to down on the street corner where you can make deposits. You might be able to get a home equity loan. You can put your savings there, et cetera. They might make business loans. There are, on the other hand, there are investment banks, which, like Goldman Sachs, for example, which trade securities. They may they advise clients on how to make their investments. They may also loan money to people so that they can turn around and invest that money. They help clients open brokerage accounts to buy securities, et cetera. Those are investment banks. There are mortgage lenders, which make mortgage loans, and some commercial banks also make mortgage loans. There are credit card issuers and other finance companies that specialize in things like issuing credit cards or credit lines or auto loans, like GMAC. That was their specialty for a long time, and then they got into the business of making other kinds of loans, like issuing credit cards. And then there are insurance companies, which pretty much specialize in selling insurance policies. But since about the early 1990s, a lot of banks and finance companies and other financial type companies have lobbied Congress, and Congress has gone along with taking down a lot of the barriers between these companies, which kind of companies can do what kind of businesses, which kind of banks can own other type of banks, etc. So throughout the 80s and 90s, the regulatory barriers have come down, and now a lot of these companies do more than one type of business. For example, AIG, the big insurance company, sold an insurance product, credit default swaps, that you can argue really are a type of security or a type of investment, because they're a derivative based on an underlying security, which is mortgage-backed bonds. And the credit default swaps that they sold, which they called insurance policies, which they really weren't, they were really a security. The market for credit default swaps grew to be $50 trillion total, which is many multiples more valuable than the underlying security, the mortgage-backed bonds that they were based on. And that market was largely unregulated, in selling those credit default swaps, AIG made millions and millions of dollars. And it's a largely unregulated market, and it's why these companies have pushed for deregulation so hard, because by becoming hybrid companies that do more than one thing, AIG, an insurance company acting like an investment bank, these companies can make enormous profits when the markets are good. When the markets are bad, well, the downside can be terrible, as we're finding out. So you might ask, okay, what is the thing with AIG? I've heard that they're getting even more money from the Federal Treasury. What's going on there? Well, when AIG was bailed out a couple of months ago, they were given $85 billion. That's now up to somewhere to about $153 billion. And the main reason why the Treasury has had to pour more money into AIG is because the original $85 billion actually hurt the company when it was given to them. And why? Because of the high interest rate. The interest rate on that initial $85 billion was set at something like 14%, which is crippling for any company. But when you give it to a company that is suffering, like AIG, it's going to lead to, well, duh, they're going to have to come back with their hand out asking for more, which is what they did. And
particularly
of course,
when they spend it all on their executives.
Which is what they did. And now the government is saying, okay, well, we'll give you $40 billion from the bailout fund, and we'll lower the interest rate a little bit. But they only lowered it to 10%, which is still a really high interest rate. So we can expect AIG to be coming back for more money in the future, I am betting. So then you might ask, okay, the other question I had this week was, what's with General Motors, okay? Should we rescue them? What's going on there? Well, General Motors came out and said that they're going to be running out of cash by the end of the year if something isn't done to rescue them. They want $25 billion, and the Democrats in Congress are lining up to give it to them. And the Republicans are saying, no, no, you can't do that. Who's right? Well, I think the answer to that is the Republicans are right. And this is why. The auto industry in this country, whether it's General Motors, Ford, or Chrysler, is too big. They've spent the last 20 years making bigger cars and trucks, selling more of those bigger cars and trucks to the American people than we really need, and they have too much capacity, and they burn too much gas. So there has to be a downsizing, and it's either got to come now or it's going to come later. If we pour $25 billion into them now, it's just putting off the inevitable. Now, you may have seen the figure of 3 million jobs lost if GM fails. That's I can argue with that seriously, because the whole auto industry in this country, all the three major automakers, directly employ less than 200,000 people. So the 3 million figure is if everybody that they're employed is laid off, everybody who sells anything to those people who are laid off is laid off, and if anybody who sells automobiles that are made in the U.S., in America, like auto dealerships, et cetera, goes out of business. That's not counting the fact that these people might get jobs doing something else, like, say, selling Japanese cars, for example, or if some of the extra capacity, the extra auto manufacturing plants are sold to foreign automakers, which I'm sure will happen. So we have to ask, okay, why the big rush then to bail out GM? It's because everything that's been done since the beginning of this crisis has been done to get our economy back to where it was 2 years ago. So the focus has been aimed at turning the clock back and doing things the way they were done in 2005 and 2006. And that can't happen because it's not sustainable. Our economy has to shrink, and the large automakers have to shrink, and the financial industry has to shrink, and it has to happen. You can't turn the clock back, but that's what the Treasury is trying to do, the Bush administration, and the Fed.
And to clarify that, it has to shrink because it was too large to be sustainable before.
Yes, it was too big to begin with. Now, the other quick things that I want to talk about is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac announced a housing rescue plan this week. Is it a good deal? Well, no. Actually, they said that they would offer their borrowers lower interest rates or longer terms on their loans in order to help them pay off their mortgages. But Fannie and Freddie only own about 20% of the delinquent mortgages in the U.S., and most of those mortgages, some 80% of the delinquent mortgages in the United States, are chopped up into mortgage-backed securities with multiple owners. So they're pretty much impossible at this point to unwind and renegotiate, because when you've got multiple owners of those mortgages, the people who are delinquent on them have to negotiate with multiple people. It's just an absolute mess. So what we need, really, is we need something like the plan that Sheila Bair at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation laid out to the Bush administration weeks ago, in which the Bush administration has kept under wraps. She finally got frustrated and announced it publicly because she knows Congress is going into session on Monday, and she wants Congress to go around the Bush administration and do something about this.
And she's a Bush appointee.
Yeah, she is a Bush appointee, and she says basically we got to use some of the bailout money to help people renegotiate their mortgages with banks. What we have to do is we have to give banks an incentive to write down the balances on loans to the market price of the homes by using bailout funds to pay half of the losses that banks would take by writing down the value of these mortgages to the actual market price of the homes. That means that banks would still lose some money on the deal, but they wouldn't lose as much as if they foreclosed on the home and had to then try to sell it at market price. So they'd get a little bit back, but they'd still take a loss, meaning they'd still pay for making bad loans, and people would still be able to stay in their homes. That's the key here. You have to stop the foreclosures from happening. You have to boost people's financial security and get consumers spending. You know, short of scrapping the capitalist system and starting over with something like a demand economy, the very first thing you have to do if you want to save our system is stabilize the housing market, since it's the root of all the problems.
She's got a good plan. You're assuming that the Bush administration cares whether people are turfed out of their homes or not.
Yeah. Well, Bush is heading out of office, so there isn't much he cares about at all at this point. So what Congress needs to do when they go into session on Monday is not pay much attention to GM. Sure, they should release the $25 billion in funds that automakers will be getting to retool their factories. They should release that immediately. Otherwise, they should ignore pleas for more money from automakers. Instead, they should adopt the FDIC plan to stabilize the housing market, set up an entity that can purchase and unwind these mortgage-backed securities so that people can renegotiate their homes out of foreclosure. They need to re-regulate all banks by setting up minimum capital standards and directing Treasury to do this as soon as possible to all banks, not just bank holding companies. They need to establish an entity to regulate derivatives like credit default swaps and mortgage-backed securities, other types of creative financial investments. And they need to remove funding from the war in Iraq and spend that money on infrastructure here at home.
All right. So that takes us over then to Proposition 8.
Yeah, there's been a real interesting backlash in the last week and a half against the passage of Proposition 8 in California, the proposition that made illegal gay marriage in that state. And it's really kind of interesting because Prop 8 wasn't getting that much attention outside the state of California. Of course, it was very controversial there, but nationally, it didn't get a whole lot of attention before the election, which, with the presidential election going on and the control for Congress and all the rest of that. But there seems to be a real tipping point, whereas there have been anti-gay amendments and initiatives and propositions on the ballots in a lot of states over the last few years, most of which have passed. And there were actually several on the ballot this year, including one in Arkansas that banned gay people from adopting children, which I think that's even worse than California, but you know, it's Arkansas, not California, so people aren't as worked up about it. But there's some interesting in the backlash, there have been some fairly troubling developments, particularly the targeting of Mormons and the targeting of blacks, when in fact, number one, it wasn't the Mormon Church who actually launched the Proposition 8 initiative. The Catholic Church did, with a lot of support from evangelicals, and then the Mormons came in when it looked like it was going to fail, and put a lot of money and volunteers into the effort in the last few weeks.
So it was a group effort.
It was the bigotries of a number of organized religions. It wasn't just the Mormons, although Mormons certainly played a key role. The second thing is that there's the meme going around that because African Americans voted in large numbers for Proposition 8, and black churches in particular tend to be quite homophobic, that made the difference. Well, anybody who's lived in California knows that the black population there is not large enough to swing the difference. And if you actually do the math, there aren't enough African Americans registered in the state to have made a difference on Prop 8 in terms of the margin of passage. And, the Latino population there is actually much larger, and Roman Catholic. And you know, if you're going to blame a minority, it's even the wrong minority to blame, probably. But really, really the appropriate target on that is Christian religion in general, not the individuals in the religion, because there are certainly a lot of people who are appalled by this who are Christians. But the organized institutions are very troubling. But today is a national day of protest against that. There are a couple things happening in the Seattle area, and we'll get to those when we talk about events at the end of the show.
Well, that actually is the perfect segue. How about some events?
Well, guess what? There's a couple of protests going on today against the passage of Proposition 8. And there's already plans underway to try and put on 2010 and a measure on the ballot in California that essentially would repeal Proposition 8 and re-legalize gay marriage in California, which I think is the way to go, is to talk about not who we're against, but what we're for. We're for equality. We're for people having equal rights under the law, and those rights not being determined by the religious beliefs of a few people who are trying to swim against the tide of history. In any event, Volunteer Park this morning, there's a pre-festival at 10:30, about an hour and a half from now. The rally begins at noon with speakers and whatnot, and then there'll be a march down to Westlake. That's midday today, and then later on today, if going to Volunteer Park and marching to Westlake isn't a direct enough connection for you, or if you want to do something more and it is a nice day outside, there will be a protest at the statewide headquarters of the LDS. That is over in Bellevue. It's at 2808 148th Avenue Southeast. 2808 148th Avenue Southeast. It's not too far away from Bellevue Community College, and that will be at 5 o'clock at the Mormon Temple there.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
Well, Eat the State is a bank holding company, at least it was as of last week. we're actually going to change the name to Bleed the State. But before that, we're waiting for our check. But before that, and probably if we don't get the check, we still will be a community newspaper that does, news and opinion and commentary and humor and whatnot. You can find it free of charge wherever you find free publications. Bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, or online at www.eatthestate.org.